The Academy Awards are just around the corner, and the front runner at the moment for Best Picture is probably The Revenant, and certainly the front runner for Best Actor is Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant. For many of us, watching that movie, which is an incredible film, might have been the first time that we saw something about the fur trade, which was so important in North America and Canada and the United States in the late 1700s and early 1800s. It built fortunes for many people, including one of the richest men in the world. Well, after seeing The Revenant, I wanted to know more about the fur trade. And of course, there is a museum of the fur trade. And Dr. Jim Hansen is there for us this morning. Jim, a very good morning and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, a lot of people would have seen the movie The Revenant, and that might have been their first encounter with the fur trade. Tell me about your connection with it.
Well, it's been an interest of mine, a lifelong interest. I grew up in this part of Nebraska, and we have a reservation nearby for Native people from the Oglala Lakota tribe. And over half of them have French surnames. And when you start tracing them down, they're all descended or have some quantum of blood from one of these fur traders who came out here to buy pelts and robes from the natives. And, you know, it was a real part of our history up until settlement occurred.
It's interesting that you say that they came to buy them from the Native Americans. Is that really the case? Was it the case that for the most part the fur trappers came and just took them?
Well, you did have, you know, one of the peculiar things was that the Plains Indians, who were horseback people, didn't really care about trapping. And as one fellow explained it, the chief of the Mandan Indians told him that he'd be happy to hunt beaver if he could do it on horseback. But the white people wanted him to come rummage in the bowels of the earth, as he put it, and he thought that was really unseemly for a man to do. So most of the tribes out here didn't trap beaver, and in order to get those pelts, which were very expensive at the time, say 1800 to 1840, a pelt would bring as much as $5, and that's a week's wages at that time. So they hired or employed white trappers to come out and hunt the beaver. And a few of the tribes were trappers, but most of them resented the white people coming out to do that, and it did cause a lot of friction and trouble, that such as what you saw in the film The Revenant.
Okay. Let's go back to the beginning, though, because I think the fur trade was starting to sort of wind down in the 1840s and 1850s. Let's go back to the start. When did it begin? When did, I suppose, white people from France or from England start venturing westward to look for fur? And what were they looking for?
Well, when the whole business started before settlement, in the early days of American history, European fishermen were coming over. This is right after Columbus. We're talking about the early 1500s. And they were catching cod, which were salted and dried and then taken back to Europe, because at that time the Catholic Church was pretty much in charge, and the Pope had declared that every Friday had to be a day of penance and you had to eat fish. So it took a lot of fish, and these fishermen, when they're drying their catch on the shore of what's now the St. Lawrence Estuary or the coast of New England, they would have Indians come up and say, "Hey, you want to sell that knife?" Or, "Boy, I like your kettle." And so the Indians began trading furs, and the Europeans were just head over heels, because these furs were worth a lot of money back in France and England. But they really, the Indians had no use for them. I mean, they were, once you got yourself clothed, they didn't need anymore. So they were happy to trade, and it was mutually beneficial. And as the furs got used up or areas got trapped out, white people began going further and further and opening up trading posts to trade with the Indians. And it just followed the progression. They were always several decades ahead of the settlement, and certainly they did all the exploring in North America before the 19th century.
So how far west did they go, and where did they go? What places are we talking about that we know now?
Well, one of the major depots of the fur trade for this region was St. Louis, and that was built by some French who, after the French and Indian War, when Canada fell and was taken over by the British, they crossed the Missouri River and set up in what they thought was going to remain French territory. Instead, the Spanish owned it for a while, then Napoleon tried to get it back, and it finally ended up part of the United States as the Louisiana Purchase. But that was certainly done by 1750. They were in the heart of the continent, and virtually everywhere had its own fur trade. In the southeastern part of the United States, it was mostly deerskins. And deerskin was used for men's pants in Europe. Anybody working outside needed rough weather togs, and buckskin was the material of choice. So over a million deerskins a year were shipped out through Charleston, South Carolina, to England and France and other parts of Europe.
So the preference was for American deer rather than deer in Europe.
Well, the trouble with those people in Europe, they thought that the royalty or the landowner owned the deer. And you remember Robin Hood.
Yes, killing the king's deer.
Exactly. The deer didn't belong to anybody but the hotshots.
Right.
And so over here, the deer were free for taking. And any Indian could, first of all, he had to hunt for his food. And once he satisfied enough deer skins for his own use, anything else he killed was just pure profit to him. And he was happy to get rid of the skins.
You're talking in a very positive way about the Native Americans, though. I'm just wondering, do you think that they were exploited, though, by the white trappers and traders?
Well, that's a good question. And in the retrospect of looking back over it, you can say, well, gee, these furs brought big money in Europe. But here's the problem. The fur was absolutely worthless sitting over here. It had to be hauled 1,000 miles to a port, New Orleans or Baltimore or New York City, then loaded into a ship, taken across the Atlantic Ocean and sold at auction, and then it got to be worth some money. And, all kinds of things could happen to it. The furs were often damaged by insects. They had no good way of killing them. The prices of a fur might go up or down, how the market is. And so it was a risky business. The fur traders normally made, by the time they got done paying for everything, the average profit was about 10% per year. And that represented a lot of hard work, and nobody got paid a retirement or health insurance or anything like that.
Dr. Jim Hansen is our guest, and he's at the Museum of the Fur Trade, which is in Nebraska, northern Nebraska. And that was kind of at the southern edge of what we would think these days of that fur trapping area, of beaver furs in particular. When did beaver fur become really the one that a lot of people made a lot of money out of? And we're talking about people like John Jacob Astor.
Well, beaver from the very beginning was, I guess it was the standard banknote, because beaver are found in virtually every part of North America. They're found even in the deserts in Nevada and so on. Any place there's running water, any place that willows will grow that beaver used for food, there was a population, and so it was the standard. But in different parts of the country, as I mentioned, deer skins. Out here, it was buffalo robes. In other parts of the country, it was martens or otters or sea otters on the northwest coast, or seals along the coasts of other parts of North America. And as well, Australia and a lot of sealers even went down into your country and brought back pelts. And most of, the interesting thing is, people think these beaver skins were used for men's hats, and they were. But the biggest single fur trading country, purchaser of furs, was China. And up until about 1840, they were the number one consumer of furs. So,
what did they want to make out of those furs?
Well, they made beautiful clothing for rich people, and then as the quality of the fur went down, pretty soon the peasants got himself a nice fur jacket while he's out plowing with his yak or whatever they plow with over there. I don't know, but at any rate, it was customary for people to wear furs in China, especially fur vests, and that was the business. But it became a huge thing because, you see, America was hard-pressed for any kind of specie, any kind of silver and gold, anything to earn an income, and farming wouldn't do that for them. So furs, the minute you got them shipped overseas, why, they would return you cash,
and, right,
and you'd be in good shape.
So was there any limit on how many beavers, for example, people could take out of the rivers or the waterways? Or did the trappers just come in and take whatever they wanted? And how soon was the beaver population depleted?
Well, that's a very good point, because there were virtually no controls on it at all. The only people who ever exercised any control over furs in the old days was the Canadians. The Hudson's Bay Company had a moratorium on trapping for several decades at different times to try to restore the beaver. But you're exactly right. When they brought in steel traps, up until then, the Indians had usually shot beaver or netted them around their houses. But with the steel trap, they became very efficient killers, and they virtually destroyed the beaver population. I will say that once the beaver market collapsed in the late 1840s, 1850, and then they simply weren't worth the trouble of taking them, beaver have increased to the point where there are now more beaver living in North America than there were before Columbus.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, one of the things I read was that the reason that the beaver trade really collapsed was because people stopped using beaver fur for their hats. They started wearing silk hats in the 1840s. Is that right?
Well, yeah, the two things kind of go hand in hand. On the one hand, as we had just discussed, they over-trapped the beaver to the point where a beaver trapper coming out here from St. Louis, traveling 1,200 or 1,500 miles to get to the source of good beaver country, couldn't catch enough to, furnish a month's wages. And so there was no point in him doing that anymore. At the same time, the silk hat became popular and rather quickly replaced it. But even today, if you go look at a cowboy store here in Wyoming or Nebraska, the hats are always a certain percentage of beaver, and the more beaver, the more expensive they are.
Now, one of the people that really made their fortune out of it, the most famous man in the fur trade, was John Jacob Astor, the founder of that Astor dynasty. Why did he become one of the richest men in the history of the world? Because partly of the beaver trade.
Well, he was a fascinating fellow. He was a German immigrant. He knew how to make a dollar. And he figured out that the way to do business was the more furs you bought, the more the market could be controlled. And rather than getting into what you saw in The Revenant, the fighting between the French trappers and the American trappers and so on, well, that was played out in a big way between the various companies that were trying to control the fur trade. But Astor came in and cut everybody part of the deal and saw to it that everybody ended up making a profit. So he was able to organize it, monopolize it, things that, today capitalism is accused of being bad for. But he got people on the same page, not working against each other, but working together. And these monopolies then suddenly began turning huge amounts of money. The other thing that he did very cleverly, he dealt in a lot of odd little furs, like, for example, muskrats. A lot of people would say, oh, muskrats aren't worth anything. They were 25-cent items. That's what they paid the Indians in trade. And he would buy up. In 1 year, he bought over 500,000 muskrat skins, had a two-day auction in New York. They brought 50 cents apiece. People said, well, that's not much money. But on 500,000 skins, he made 25 cents on a skin. I mean, it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So he saw the value of every kind of fur, not just beaver.
Right.
That was very romantic. But so at any rate, the end result was he made lots of money. And he also said, you know, this is not the best business to be in because it's very volatile. And he sold out in 1834. To some guys who couldn't think of anything else to do but be in the fur trade, some of those French guys from St. Louis. And he then took his paltry few million that he'd managed to make in the China trade first and in the fur trade, and then he bought real estate around the city of New York. And son of a gun, that paid off pretty well.
Yes, it did. And Astoria, I think, as in the Waldorf Astoria, takes its name from one of the camps, one of the forts, wasn't it?
Absolutely. He had part of his idea. It was a great idea. It just didn't work out. But he sent an expedition across the continent and one by sea to the mouth of the Columbia. Their purpose was to collect furs when the ships going to China to buy all that tea, all that wonderful porcelain, all that wonderful silk. What did the Chinese want? They didn't need anything, but they did love furs. And so Astor would collect enough furs there, that was the idea, and send it over to the market in China. But unfortunately, the War of 1812 interfered, and the British took it over.
Now, tell me about the Museum of the Fur Trade. How long has this been going?
Museum was started as an idea to people said, you know, they're tired of seeing Indians fighting the cavalry, Indians fighting the cowboys in all the movies, and there was a long period of friendship. Obviously, I mentioned that half the people are part French up here on the nearby Indian reservation. And so they began looking for the site of a trading post where they could interpret a little more of the friendly business history and the symbiosis that grew up between whites and Indians. And this site was finally selected in 1953. The museum opened in 1955, and here we are all these years later.
And many people would visit Mount Rushmore. I've been there myself, but only about 100 miles south of that is your museum. So people can visit that if they're going to Mount Rushmore.
That's correct.
Very nice. Now, you've also had something to do with The Revenant, haven't you? Tell me what your role was.
Well, I was hired. I'm kind of at the end of my career, and unfortunately I know too much, as they say, but was hired by them to mostly check their script and to help them with things like how would the Indians have been dressed, what kind of war paint would they be wearing. We worked on their costumes for the mountain men, and we published books on that sort of thing, and so I was kind of a fact checker for them, and it was a lot of fun. They were good people to work with.
How right did they get it, do you think?
Oh, you know, always give them about 80%, but, you know, as the man said, this wasn't a documentary, it's a movie, and as the director said, and I agree with him absolutely. You know, if I had $130 million to spend on a movie, why, I think they did a good job.
Okay. It wasn't a documentary, you're right. It was an adventure story, but it was based on a real-life person. What can you tell us about him?
Well, Hugh Glass was a Scot, apparently. In fact, someone who ran into him a couple years after the bear attack said that he had a kilt or had kilts with him and his Balmoral, his Scotch cap. So, you know, it gives you a little different picture of him. He was an older fellow. Some people think he was born about 1780, but possibly even earlier than that. He was described by a medical doctor in 1825 as possibly 75 years old. I think that was a little too much. But anyway, they called him Father Glass. And he had been sailing with, a cargo of goods on the northern Atlantic and they were captured by pirates, and they gave him the option of either walking the plank or joining them, and so he became a pirate for a short time. And when they were on the Gulf of Mexico, he escaped overboard and swam ashore, joined a group of Indians called the Karankawa Indians, and they were interesting because they were basically cannibals, but they didn't choose to eat him. Maybe he was too old and tough. And at any rate, he lived with them for several years and then gradually migrated north and ended up with the Pawnees in what's now Nebraska. Joined up as a beaver trapper in 1823, and the rest of it is what you saw in the movie, except that he wasn't able to kill the man who had left him for dead, and eventually died about 1828, killed by some of those same Indians that you saw in the movie.
Amazing story. It shows you how unbelievably tough and rugged life was in that part of the world, in that job. Do you think, in fact, in some ways the movie sugarcoated it, that it was really a very rough and rugged life?
Oh, you know, the cold, I just every day I think about that, how difficult it was, and everybody was soaking wet. And as one fellow said, you know, these guys work like convicts, but none of them would give it up because they're free and they can do as they please, and they think this is really the life to lead. But there was a doctor who described Hugh Glass and met him and heard about the bear incident and got him to take his clothes off. And he said that he had chasms where his right bicep had been. The bear had bitten off his right bicep. The bear had bitten off half of his shoulder blade on the right side, and the bear had bitten his right thigh away. So this is what he was left with, and now he was still hale and hearty and going to the mountains again. So
unbelievable. But, you know, people like Astor made a lot of money out of it, obviously. What about the actual fur trappers themselves? Did they retire as rich men?
No, they didn't. You know, they had such a hard life. Usually they'd have an annual gathering where everybody would bring in their furs and sell them. And they spent their, you know, like the old joke, they spent their money on fast horses and fast women and liquor, and some of it they wasted. So it was kind of like that here. Very few of them ended up with anything. The ones who did were the men who decided to be the suppliers, like Astor. There was a man named Robert Campbell who moved back to St. Louis. He'd been a trapper out here. He retired and became a millionaire selling goods to people supplying the fur trade. So it was possible to make money, but you really had to get out of doing the day-to-day work.
How strong is the fur trade today?
Well, you know, it's changed tremendously. The big thing that's changed is that wild furs are not much sought. First of all, there's a lot of people who find taking furs with, you know, mechanical means is pretty barbaric. Most of the traps today are what we call killer traps. They kill the animal almost instantly, but. But the smart thing to do is now with fur farms, you can genetically engineer, just like with cattle or anything else, the product that you get. And the big problem, if you're making a fur coat and it takes, let's say, 40 minks to make a fur coat, you want them all to look the same size, same color, and so on. And you can do that in cages, but you can't do that out in the wild. So in order to get the furs to make a nice wild mink coat, it takes a huge number for you to sort through. And so anyway, that's the big change. And furs are still a leading item going to China. They're back in the fur trade in a big way. And Scandinavia produces a great many of the furs that we use. But there are some fur farms here, and people still trap. And the price, you know, fluctuates kind of based on what the Chinese market is. Sometimes things like bobcats get up around $600 or $800 a piece. And then there'll be a change in the market, and they'll fall back to 100 or so. So, you know, that's just the luck of working with commodities.
Indeed. It's no different to anything else. There's so much more we can talk about, but thank you very much, Jim, for telling us about the fur trade, and people can visit your website as well, or if they happen to be in Nebraska, in the far north of Nebraska, they can visit the museum as well in person. Jim, thank you so much.
Well, it's been my absolute pleasure, sir, and thank you so much. Good luck to all our friends in Australia.
And that is Dr. Jim Hansen from the Museum of the Fur Trade, and that was our museum piece this morning.